So much on the radio, from the surprise hit film of the lockdown, My Octopus Teacher, the randomness of decision-making in a noisy world, and keeping yourself cyber-safe. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
Asking Johnny Logan and Dana to fix the Eurovision is like asking Beethoven to fix the X Factor. You know, it's 50 or 60. I think Johnny Logan won it in, I think it was 1890.
Cybercrime is very common, isn't it?
It is. I mean, look, there's an estimate that there's an attack about every 30 seconds globally.
And I think it's a bit of a misnomer now at this stage to be calling it a song contest. It looked more like a soft porn show to me.
What do you mean? Low cut and tight and short?
Yeah, and the suspender belts and all that kind of thing.
That was the fellas. What about the women?
And we'll start here on the Ryan Tubridy Show. Now, have you watched the film about a man suffering with burnout who finds solace and life lessons from a wild octopus? My Octopus Teacher has been a surprise hit, picking up an Oscar and lots of love for its tender and slow story. So I was delighted in the morning to hear that Ryan was talking to Barry Donnelly. Now, Barry is the man behind the sounds. And as a landlocked Midlands dweller, I miss the sound of the sea and the underwater world. So it was one of the best bits of the film for me. So Barry spoke to Ryan from South Africa.
You're in South Africa, and you're of very Irish extraction, despite you never having been here before. So you can lay out your credentials before we kick off.
Well, my great-grandfather was born in Ireland and then moved to South Africa in the early 1900s. And our family has been in South Africa ever since. So, yeah, I've never been to Ireland, unfortunately, but love to come one day.
And your daughter's names?
My daughter is Tara, and my other daughter's Erin, and my nephew's Ryan, and another one's Liam. You know, we're all more Irish than the Irish.
Honestly, good, and yeah, and not a trip home yet, but you'll get there eventually,
no.
I have no doubt.
Yeah.
You're also your movie credential. You worked on District 9.
That's correct, yeah.
Invictus, Deception, all great films. I mean, District 9 was a bonkers film, wasn't it?
It was. It was also one of those films, like My Octopus Teacher, which wasn't really expected to do as well as it did. So very fortunate that way.
And again, the sound was essential to that film.
Yeah, I was just a small part in that film because most of the audio post-production was done in New Zealand, I believe. But it was just great to be involved in it.
Now, tell me about My Octopus Teacher. When they came to you and said, Barry, listen, Craig Foster is the guy who conceived, he wrote, he filmed, he stars in this documentary. You know him through family and what have you. When they said to you, OK, here it is, it's the guy, Craig goes down, he becomes friendly with an octopus. Would you like to work in this programme? How do you react to such a thing?
Well, I've always worked with Craig and loved working with him from... I've been working with him for over 20 years, so hopefully I was the natural choice to do the sound on this film. But yeah, he kind of said, look, if we're going to work on this film, you need to experience what it's like to dive. So he took me diving and to experience the whole world, and he did that with the color graders as well. To everyone involved in the production had to experience it to, you know, give that reality.
What is My Octopus Teacher? I mean, how do you describe it in a few sentences, Barry?
It's a reconnecting with nature. And it came out at the correct time. We were all in lockdown. Everyone is feeling very isolated. Mm. And it was just great timing, I think. And that's why it's done so well. People just have connected with it. In such a positive way.
Yeah, I can understand. I'd heard about it, Barry, and I was thinking, okay, I'm a bit cynical, and I came at it with an arched eyebrow, and then within minutes I was hypnotised. And I've heard that from people. They say that it's very, as I say, zen, and it's quite vibey, trippy almost.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a weird connection. I mean, people have octopi as pets and things, but it's not the same as this connection in the wild that we can have with nature.
And Barry explained how the relationship between the octopus and Craig developed.
Well, as you know in the documentary, the octopus is very hesitant, to kind of trust Craig. But over the time that they had spent together, there was this connection with nature. And, you know, I think it's similar with how we treat our pets in real life. You know, we have a connection with them. Even though an octopus is wild and cautious, but they've got a big brain, and you know they use it to their full advantage, as you can see with the way it camouflages itself, etc.
Which was extraordinary too. I think you said something a minute ago, which is so valid to what we're talking about this morning, which was that the documentary fell. If it's all about timing, it fell at such a good time, whereby sea swimming has become the badge of honour now around the place.
It's probably
the same in South Africa. People who wouldn't have as much as dipped a toe in a rock pool are now in there every morning for an hour or less, but just dipping their heads has become soul food for people.
Yeah, I mean, the nature is the new game reserve. As you know, in South Africa, we have fantastic game reserves, but no one's ever really thought too much about the sea and the role that that has to play in the environment. So this film has really highlighted that, which is what it was aimed to do.
Now, Craig, who's the man behind the documentary, it tells us at the beginning of that his mental health was suffering after burnout and that this routine was very, very helpful. And I think people have had a very emotional reaction to My Octopus Teacher. Have you? Did you have such a reaction, Barry?
Definitely. And, you know, every time I watch it, I shed a tear every time. You know, it's very emotional. You kind of really fall in love with the octopus by the end of the film.
Well, he's not wrong. And then Ryan asked about creating the sound for the film. And this was a bit of a shocker.
Well, basically, because the film is underwater, there is no real sound. So everything is created from scratch.
Right.
Every little flipper, every fishtail, every rockfall, every wave is put in by the sound department.
Wait a minute.
So Craig and I
wait a minute. So if I see the seaweed moving or fish fin flapping or something creaking, where that's not caught on a microphone or a hydrophone?
No, nothing. So that's all done after the fact. So things like the seaweed, I had a big pile of seaweed in my studio later that we were creaking and making noises out of, and you know, everything is recreated, which is fun.
What do you use for you know, the gloopy sounds or noises? How do you?
So all the gloopy stuff is cold glue, either that or that kind of kid slime. We use a lot of that stuff. We use things like, for the octopus tentacles, I would use a sticky bath mat. You know, it's got, kind of got those suckers underneath. So it's all not reality, but we try to make it reality. So the viewer believes that it's all real, which hopefully we achieved.
You are 100%. You kind of wrecked my buzz a little bit with that news, but I do understand that's your job. You're really good at it, obviously. In my innocence, good Lord, that's amazing. And the octopus, the reaction, broadly speaking, Barry, to My Octopus Teacher has been enormously positive. I won the Best Documentary Oscar just last month. Why do you think people have connected so well around the world?
As I say, I think it's a timing thing. I think just people needed it in a big way. You know, there's a lot of mental health issues going around with COVID at the moment, and I think people connect on that level too. Not just the connecting with nature side; it's the whole mental health side.
I see that. Also, Craig's how is he, by the way, since all of this?
He's actually taken it very well. You know, he doesn't like the spotlight, and that was one of the reasons for his burnout. And I told him he needs to stop making successful movies if he wants to.
For sure.
But he's good. He swims every day, sometimes twice a day. He also has a freezer full of ice that he dives into when he feels the need, yeah. Which is very bizarre, but he enjoys that, so...
And I understand that there's in the rather vulgar topic of money and royalties and so on. You, or at least Craig, doesn't really benefit after the once-off payment. Is that how it works? No royalties for the filmmakers?
As far as I'm aware, I think that is the case. I'm not involved in the money side at
sure.
all. As creatives, we don't think about money. We just want to create art.
I absolutely believe you.
So, how many times has Barry watched the film?
Oh, probably about 50 times.
Really? Why so long and so many?
Well, you know every single frame of the movie by the time you're done with it, because I've put in sound for every single frame of the movie. So, and I've been fortunate enough to watch it with lots of people and to see the reactions. It's always nice to watch it with people for the first time. It's very special.
We watched Texas, the octopus teacher, my octopus teacher, and shed a few tears a few months ago. And we are now a house of five vegetarians. I don't think I could ever stomach eating octopus or calamari or squid ever again. It's so easy to forget we can have a healthy diet without killing any living creature. I mean, how's your vegetarian world, Barry? Are you in a meat, a carnivore or omnivore or herbivore?
Oh, I'm a definite carnivore still, I'm afraid.
Calamari. There's only one calamari. A tweet says the sound effects are created by a Foley artist named for an Irishman in early Hollywood.
That's correct, yeah. I think his first name was Maxwell, but I'm not quite sure.
There you go, the Foley's.
It was done all the way back then, yeah.
Okay, well, that's good news. The Irish tentacles, to use the analogy, are spread all over the world from old Hollywood to modern South Africa.
Sound engineer Barry Donnelly there. And, of course, Ryan's listeners couldn't have left the story of Jack Donovan Foley unsaid.
Jack Donovan Foley, yes, was the developer of many sound effect techniques used in filmmaking. He's credited with developing a unique method for performing sound effects live and in synchrony with the picture during a film's post-production. Accordingly, individuals engaged in this trade are called Foley artists. Thank you for letting me know about that, Mr. Jack Donovan Foley. I lived in the years 1891 to 1967.
From the Ryan Tuberty Show. So here's an interesting question posed by Claire Byrne in the morning. Why are police officers more lenient with people who have the same name as them? Are they? Well, Olivier Sibonet and Cass Sunstein have just published a book looking at the lottery of decision-making and judgment in humans. It's called Noise, and they were talking to Claire.
Olivier, can I start with the obvious question? When you say noise, what exactly do you mean?
We mean noise in the statistical sense when we apply it to judgments. And what we mean by this is that noise is unwanted variability in judgments. Whenever you would want judgments to be identical and they are not, we call this noise.
Do we expect that most judgments are more or less consistent, that two different people with similar expertise would come up with a reasonably close judgment on the very same thing?
Well, the big issue here is what you mean by reasonably close. By definition, when we say it's a matter of judgment, we don't expect people to agree exactly. If you say how much is 2 plus 2, you expect people to agree exactly, but you wouldn't say this is a matter of judgment. When you ask two doctors, how severe is this disease, you would expect them to agree pretty much all the time. And on some problems, you would expect a little more disagreement. And what we found when we looked at a lot of different domains is that basically there is always a lot more disagreement than people think. There is always a lot more noise than people expect. And that's one of the main themes of the book. Whenever there is judgment, there is noise and more of it than you think.
So, Cass, well, let's talk about some examples of this. In the world of medicine, for example, which I know you looked at, is it noisy?
I want to be careful here because I have Irish doctors in my family, but the answer is yes, there's a lot of noise. So if you go to two doctors, one might say, yes, you have lung cancer, and the other might say, I think you probably don't have lung cancer, let's wait. One might say you have heart disease, we got to do a battery of tests and then maybe have an operation. Another might say you have a lot of stress, go home. So we detect a ton of noise in the practice of medicine.
That's a bit frightening because I would assume as a lay person that I would go to a medic and they would look at all of my test results and make a judgment based on what they are seeing on paper or on their screen, not using their own opinion.
Well, they do look at the materials and their opinions might turn out to be the same, but there's often judgment even in the interpretation of x-rays. So it wouldn't be fair to say that doctors are random, but it would be fair to say that doctors are noisy, and that can result in overdiagnosis, which is really expensive and not a lot of fun for patients, and underdiagnosis, which is a little bit of a relaxing for patients, but might mean they get really, really sick and possibly even die.
Was it the case as well that when you spoke to experts on all of this, that they themselves were shocked by how much they differed?
Completely. So whenever we've talked to people in business, for example, and asked them to estimate the amount of noise there is, they give a low number, not zero, but a low number. And then when we've tested it, the actual level of noise is much higher. So we suggest in business and medicine and law all over the place, noise audits are a really good idea. And frequently you're going to find that you have a big problem, which results in costs, in illness, and often in acute unfairness.
Okay, we might talk more about those audits in a moment, but coming back to medicine, you found as well that doctors prescribe more drugs at the end of the day than at the start.
Yes. So where you are in the day really matters to what kind of medical treatment you're going to get often. So in the end of the day, when doctors are tired, they might just say, well, we're going to give the medicine. It's okay. Whereas in the early in the day, when they're high energy, they might think everyone's high energy and think, well, drugs are not such a good idea. We're going to be more careful in prescribing. And this can vary from domain to domain. So there's a recent study that actually came out of around the same time as the book, which finds that doctors prescribe statins actually more in the morning than in the afternoon. In the afternoon, they stop doing it. And that shows noise within the person, not within a system, within a single individual.
And Olivia, when we talk about noise, is noise the same as bias? If you get two people assessing the same decision, one might be biased in a certain way.
We are thinking about noise as a problem of organizations, a problem of systems. So if you have a doctor, to take Cass's example again, who is biased in favor of prescribing statins very often, then that's clearly a bias of the doctor. But if you have another doctor in the same hospital who is biased in against prescribing statins when they need to be prescribed, and if you look at the average level of prescription of statins in the hospital, you might say it's fine. But actually, it's not fine. It's fine on average, so there is no bias on average in the hospital. But because the two individuals that you're dealing with have very different biases, you actually have a lot of error, and that error is noise. You would have the same problem if you said, look, my company is not biased in its hiring because when we look at the gender of the people we're hiring, it's identical to the number of people who apply, and we don't have a bias against or in favor of women. But if it turns out that half your recruiters are biased against women and the other half is biased in favor of them, you're still making a lot of mistakes. Half of these recruiters are not hiring the right people because they favor one particular gender. The other half is not hiring the right people because they favor another gender. So bias is what you would observe at the level of the organization, and you can have no bias and still have a lot of noise. Bias and noise are, in fact, two sides of the same coin of error, and they add up in a way that we don't suspect. We think of bias all the time, we don't think much of noise, and that's what we're trying to talk about here.
And Cass Sunstein explained how noise in the justice system can be a lottery.
Well, if you're convicted of a crime, you're about to enter a lottery. That's not good news. In the lottery, you might get a judge who is very favorable to people like you, and you're going to get a lenient sentence. Or you might get a judge who's very severe with respect to people like you, and you might find yourself in jail for a really long time. So what we find is that a key moment in deciding the future of people who've been convicted of crimes is the moment in which a judge is often randomly chosen to be the one who presides over the case. This is true in legal systems all over the world. In some cases, it's a true horror where someone can be treated super leniently or with terrific severity. In other places, it's just really bad and scandalous, but it's often unmeasured. So far as I'm aware, in Ireland and Germany and France, we actually don't have measurements of the level of noise in criminal sentencing.
So if, for example, Olivier Cass was stopped for speeding, he would be fortunate if the police officer who stopped him was named Olivier.
That's correct. And our son, whose mother is Irish, is named Declan, and we visit Declan a lot. And one thing I had in my mind was if he's ever stopped for a speeding violation, there are a lot of Declans in Ireland, so he might be okay. Actually, that's not why we named him Declan. But the data is very clear that if your first name is Declan in Ireland and you're stopped by a police officer, you're in better shape than if you're stopped in, say, France.
It was extraordinary to see that you're more likely to get a harsher sentence on a hot day, and surely we wouldn't expect something as arbitrary as that.
completely. So circumstances, whether your favorite sports team won or lost, if you're the judge, whether you're really hot, whether you're really tired, those can affect how you deal with people whose life is on the line. And what we find in the domain of criminal sentencing, it also applies in medicine, it applies in business, it applies all over the place. And this can produce real unfairness, of course, but it also can result in big mistakes where a happy person can do one thing and a sad person can do another thing, and both might be wrong.
Olivier Sibonet and Cass Sunstein, authors of Noise, from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the afternoon, Liveline was dominated with opinions on Ireland's performance at the Eurovision Song Contest qualifier.
The Irish entrant was Leslie Roy, and the song was called Maps, But Have We Lost Our Way? When it comes to the Eurovision, that's the opinion of some of our callers, at least. Paul, good afternoon. Paul McKeown, Eurovision super fan for many, many long years, we know here on Liveline. What happened last night, Paul? What do you think went wrong?
Hello, Joe. Thanks for having me on. First of all, I just wanted to say Rotterdam did host it excellent given the COVID conditions. So, yeah. Let's not forget that we were under a lot of pressure and no one was, you know, sick or anything. I think what went wrong last night, again, remember, it's a song contest. I think Ireland are doing their best. I think Leslie was a great ambassador for Ireland. Mm. I think in all the reviews and all her kind of bloggers out there, they really think Leslie is amazing. But again, it's a song contest. And I think the song on the night just was not strong enough, Joe. It really wasn't.
And how did we compare in terms of, did you see the Malta, in terms of pyrotechnics, so to speak, and a television spectacle?
Well, Leslie and her kind of group did say they're trying something different. And they did last night. It didn't work for me. You know, the song, while it's a song contest, it's a show contest as well. Okay. So every country is putting on the best performance. That's the voice, the song, the pyros, everything needs to be top-notch on the night. I think they tried something different, RTE and Leslie. It didn't work.
And just didn't get through. For people who didn't see it, how would you describe what they did?
Well, obviously, she was trying to... Maps is a song about a journey, and Leslie wrote the song with two others about her journey in the last year or two and getting to Eurovision and the COVID situation. She tried to tell a story of a storybook, but for me, the paper sections didn't work. I didn't know what it was about. She was looking into a camera, and again, I was a bit lost to see what she was doing. And then she went off. She was on a treadmill. She was running around. And her vocals on the night were not the best I've seen or heard. So I think
If you're running around and on a treadmill, you wouldn't... Surely you'd be out of breath.
You would. But again, she wouldn't be the only one.
Well, that's Paul. Then Dermot also spoke to Joe.
I was gutted last night that Leslie didn't qualify. I was anxious all along that, you know, I thought it was going to be a struggle for her to qualify. I think last night's semi-final was probably one of the toughest semi-finals over the past 10 years. So she was always... it was always going to be an uphill battle for her to qualify.
And what did you think of the performance and the staging and the... Like, there seemed to be a mess up at the start. There was silences and...
But in fairness, that really... when that happened last night, I got very worried as well. But in hindsight, in fairness, that had nothing to do with the Irish performer or anything. It was a technical issue with a television camera broke down. So, but again...
So that's nothing to do with the RTE or the Irish...
It had nothing to do with RTE or Leslie. But in fairness, it probably wouldn't have helped Leslie's nerves because she was just about to start her song.
They
and
would have
happened.
Said, hang on.
That's it. And I mean, it was only maybe a two or three minute delay, but that could have seemed like an eternity to Leslie when she stand on the stage.
It's like going back to the Atlanta Olympics in 1986, I think, was it? When Michelle Smith, she couldn't find her... She had goggles, but she couldn't find her proper goggles. So that discommode, remember she had to run back in.
Like that can completely throw you. But look at what RTE did with the performance last night. And I mean, it was something new. It was exciting. It was ambitious. It might have been a bit over-ambitious. I mean, on paper, pardon the pun, but in theory, you know, it all sounded amazing. Either it worked on the night, I'm not 100% sure. I don't think it came across as well as it was hoped that it would.
Okay, now yesterday on our program, well, it was on the promo, we mentioned that Jedward called for a boycott of Israel, who were in there, I mentioned it yesterday. They were in our group last night. We're number 7, they were number 12. They got through, even though, judging by if you read any media at the moment, any newspapers, there is if you look at the demonstrations around the world, including Dublin, there's a big anti-Israeli movement out there, but they still got through.
There is, but in fairness, at the end of the day, Eurovision is a song contest, so it shouldn't really be political. Now, I did fear for the Israeli, because in fairness to Eden, the Israeli performer, I mean, she really does deserve her place in the final on Saturday night. I mean, vocally, she was very strong. I mean, it's a very catchy song with a great performance. It deserved to make it to the final on Saturday night. Now, I did fear with the current situation, I just thought people across Europe might not pick up the phone and vote for Israel. I mean, and that has nothing to do with the Israeli performer. She has no control over it. But I just did think in the current political situation that it may not qualify. And in fairness, Israel came out of the envelopes very early in the game. So I think they came out second. So as soon as Israel came out, it kind of diminished.
And how many of the 16 entries last night, how many didn't make it out of the semi-final?
Six.
Okay. And Maeve called just to say that Leslie was only great.
I thought she did a terrific job. As I said to your researcher there, I don't know her from Adam. She looked as if she was... I don't know whether this has been said before now because I've been holding on, but she looked as if she was trying to get out of a jungle and kind of try and hold a note at the same time. I thought that was ridiculous. I thought she was a lovely girl, and I think it's a bit of a misnomer now at this stage to be calling it a song contest. It looked... the Israeli one, and there was another one as well, it looked more like a soft porn show to me. You'd be... I don't think you'd be too busy looking or listening to the song.
What do you mean soft porn,
mate? The way they were dressed and everything, you know what I mean? Like, it's supposed to be... I know, you can have a show and make it enjoyable and everything.
What do you mean, low-cut and tight and short?
And suspender belts and all that kind of thing.
That was the fellas. What about the women?
Yeah, well, there was a couple of very dubious... I thought the song was okay. It was as good as any of the ones that went through.
Okay, and you're surprised we didn't get through.
I was surprised too that the Israeli song, because like that, whoever was on there before me was saying, I thought with the angst and all that, what's going on out there at the moment, that they wouldn't get a vote at all. But when I heard that went through, I said, not good. I think now we're battling here, and so it proved to be true.
And later, all kinds of everything remind me of Dana.
And Dana, you're listening. Do you think, are people being unfair to Leslie Roy?
Well, I just want to say thank you to Leslie. And okay. I think I'd be speaking for all the Eurovision entrants that I know that have gone from Ireland, because we know what it's like to go on there, the pressure, the nerves, the anxiety. There'd be nobody feeling more down about the result than Leslie herself. But she is a good artist. It was a good song. Mm-hmm. And she gave it her best, Joe. And I think, really, we just need to say thanks to her and encourage her to just keep her head up and keep going. She didn't let us down.
And what do you think of the overall? Did you watch much of it, Dana?
I did. I watched all of it.
Okay. And what did you think, generally?
Well, I think there were some very strong songs in there. Mm-hmm. You know, when I took part, as you rightly said, it was a different time and it was a simpler presentation. And sometimes I feel the artist is fighting with the effects behind them, you know. And sometimes the effects are extraordinarily beautiful and they combine with the song and the singer and they're fine. But sometimes they're distracting.
Just to remind people, well, a lot of people remember anyway because it's an iconic image, isn't it? It's still used everywhere. That when you represented Ireland and won it, I think you were 17, were you, Dana? What age?
Well, no, I'm willing to lie about this now, Joe. I think I was 12. Would you accept that one? No, I don't think you would.
I think
no.
You were 16 or 17. I don't know, but you were young.
Everybody thinks I was 14 and I don't put them out their wrist now. I just let them go.
Okay, but you were just sitting on a stool, weren't you, really?
I was, and I wasn't having to kind of sprint almost as Leslie was doing and work with other props and things. And I just wanted to say thanks, Leslie. And you did a good job. You gave your best, and you're a good artist. And it was a good song.
Have you heard this young child, Emma Sophia, singing all kinds of everything?
Isn't that gorgeous? And how can I see her? I must see her now. I'll have to make a point of seeing her.
Yeah, she does it. She does it extraordinarily well.
Does she?
Extraordinarily. There she is. There.
Thank you.
She's lovely.
Oh, the cuteness. That's Dana on the live line with Joe Duffy. Then later, another Eurovision titan was talking to Ray Darcy about the situation.
Oh, I come from a nation what knows how to write a song. Oh, Europe, where did it all go?
Indeed, he comes from a nation what knows how to write a song. Europe, where did it all go wrong? Dustin.
Where did it all go wrong, indeed? I still have the shopping trolley. It only cost me €2 now. That's mad. Sorry, I'm still getting... I caught you on the live line there. I love them. They release them every year. They put the Euro nuts on. They just keep them, lock them up in RT and then release them every year around Eurovision to get... Look, asking Johnny Logan and Dana to fix the Eurovision is like asking Beethoven to fix the X Factor. You know, it's 50 or 60. I think Johnny Logan won it in, I think it was 1890, and there was only three countries in it. There was Wyoming, France, and Roscommon. I mean, like, it's just barking mad. I love... By the way, look, fair play to Leslie last night. I thought she's absolutely brilliant. I genuinely did. I thought we should have got through.
Yeah.
But then, like, six countries don't, and that's just the way it's... The cookie crumbles. The cookie crumbles, as they say.
Yeah, you represented Ireland.
I come from a nation. I still got it, Ralph. I still got it. Yeah. I got... Booked the ticket. I put me being forward again. So, I actually heard that actually Roy Keane and Danny Healy, Ray and Socky are putting together a band for next year. That should be good.
So 2008, Belgrade, in Serbia, and you failed to qualify. And
I think Belgrade's still in Serbia,
yeah. I'm thinking about your experience there, Dustin, and what was it like? Were you nervous? Because a lot of people are saying that Leslie looked a little bit nervous last night.
Look, if anyone, no matter what a season performer, how brilliant, and then, like, I've had 8 number ones, and I know I have an amazing voice, and I know that people said it was Michael's two-bass voice at the time. It wasn't really me singing. I can just clarify that it was me singing, right? But, right, it's what Pearson Connolly fought and died for. It's the best crack you're ever going to have in your life, going to Eurovision. But if you're not nervous, there's something wrong with you. I think I laid an egg in my shopping trolley. I was so nervous, but I hope it was an egg. But it was just, like, I mean, I was the one who said, you know, Eastern Europe, we love you. Do you like Irish stew or goulash as it is to you? And I didn't get through on that. So what hope does anyone else have?
There are a lot of people are blaming
you. Get Dana back on the line.
Doesn't, to be serious for a moment, a lot of people are blaming you for the fact that Ireland haven't done well since. They feel that...
Well, thanks very much. Thank you. That
the Eurovision took it as an insult when we sent you out to represent us.
I just put that straight. It's like being on Claire Byrne here. I'll just answer that question. The reason I went in, was it 2008?
Yes.
Was because the year before that, Ireland finished plumb last.
Right.
And I think the year before that, a couple of Eurostar rejects went over and finished last.
Right, okay.
So, I mean, if I curse this fair play, I've saved the country a fortune. Right?
Yeah.
So I'm happy with that. But, I mean...
Right. You know. So, seeing as you've been there, and a lot of people, obviously, who we've heard opinions from, haven't been there. They haven't experienced it. They haven't appeared in front of all those millions of people across Europe, felt the sense of going out live on stage and everything that goes with it, laying an egg and everything. How do you think we can improve our Eurovision entries, Dustin?
Roy Keane and Saki and Danny Healy, okay.
Right?
Look, you have to gender balance there. I think we could throw in Miriam McCallaghan or something. But look, look, Leslie did a brilliant job last night. She didn't get through. We just keep on trying. Yeah. And then we get the Euro nuts on live line every year after. We have great crack. Like, listen to the news. There's a homeless crisis. And you have these lads going on about it. It's brilliant.
It's a bit of court. Okay.
Leslie did her best.
She did.
Fair play to her.
That's Dustin. Who else on The Ray D'Arcy Show? And given that data security has been in the news lately because of the cyber attacks on the HSE, tech journalist Ciara O'Brien was talking to Claire Byrne in the morning.
So we've all become much more conscious of our own security since the HSE cyber attack. But cybercrime is very common, isn't it?
It is. I mean, look, there's an estimate that there's an attack about every 30 seconds globally. So you're not only talking about ransomware attacks like we saw with the HSE this week, but also phishing attacks, fake sites, viruses, these attacks called DDoS attacks. Basically, the cybercrime is quite big. It's an industry now. So people think, they see that the likes of the HSE attack, and obviously it's something huge, so it's attention grabbing. But this kind of low level attacks are always going on in the background. And even actually with ransomware attacks, more are happening than people realise. It's just you don't always hear about them because they don't affect us. Mm-hmm. Something like the HSE, I mean, it's our health system. Obviously it grabs attention. We think, it's our health data. Whereas, it could be a small company that's been hit by a ransomware attack and you'd never find out about it.
And what's the most common type of scam that people would succumb to? Because we all get the text messages or the emails that look dodgy, but what are the ones that tend to catch people out?
Lately, the ones that a lot of people are seeing and falling for are things like a text message that you get claiming to be from a delivery company. I mean, obviously, with Brexit, now we have a lot more to deal with in terms of paying customs charges on items that we've ordered that would have come from the UK. These started even before Brexit, and couple of members of my own family got them, and that was the kind of the giveaway because we knew that there weren't going to be custom charges in November for something that was coming from Britain. So they were fairly obvious to spot, but these attacks are getting more and more sophisticated, and a lot of the time when you go to the websites, unless you know what to look for, and even when you do know what to look for, a lot of the time it's they're so clever and they're so good that people are being fooled by it, and you're handing over either financial data or personal data, and all this has value.
What's the basic rule then, Ciara, when it comes to messages like that?
The basic rule would be if you have ordered something, they'll give you a tracking number. And even those texts that arrived, they had a tracking number with it. Check the tracking number for a start, and check it by going to the website independently of the link that comes in that text message. If you click on that link, it'll send you to a dodgy website. If you get something that claims to be from DPD or OnPost, if you go to OnPost's website by actually going and typing in the address into the website bar yourself, you'll get to the genuine one. And if you put a tracking number in, obviously that tracking number is going to be fake. And that's how, to be honest, that's how I've checked a few myself, because I've got some very clever ones that, had I not been aware that this was going on, I might have fallen for it. And, and it's not even just coming by text message. I mean, my mother, for example, got a phone call claiming to be from Amazon about her Amazon Prime subscription. Now, this isn't the first time it's happened. I'd completely forgotten about it, but the same thing happened last year, saying that, your Amazon Prime subscription was overdue and it was going to be charged unless you wanted to talk to somebody from customer service. And the idea being that, obviously you'll talk to somebody who is not from Amazon at all, because Amazon don't ring your home phone. They'll send you an email, or they'll go through their own. And when you log into the website, they'll let you know that your subscription is expiring. But these are, there were so many people who actually contacted me about that recently. And then it happened again to my mother while I was in the house, Right. And if you don't know what to look for, it's very easy to fool you.
It is. And in our house, we got one this week from purporting to be from the Department of Social Protection. And you do have to stop and think and remind yourself that this is likely to be a scam. And then people will remember on Liveline yesterday, the Bank of Ireland one, which tricked so many people because it looked perfectly legit unless you just, you had to actually stop yourself from acting. Can we talk about passwords, Ciara? How do hackers find out your password?
Well, assuming you aren't using something that's very obvious, like your birthday or your pet's name, or something that's very easily guessed, like a common password, what happens is your passwords will often have been leaked in one of the many, many data breaches that have happened. I mean, I've lost track of the number of emails that I've gotten to say, oh, we're very sorry, we've had a data breach, your password details were taken, but no financial data was taken. So this is, I mean, if you're the type of person who reuses passwords, and look, we all are, we've all done it. I don't think there's anybody who can claim to be perfect when it comes to this, unless they actually work in cybersecurity themselves and they know the risks. I mean, I've reused passwords. Obviously, I don't anymore. But if you do reuse passwords and your details have been taken, you know, what will happen is that they're sold on. You know, somebody may try them in different websites, and it's just a case of, you know, trying to get lucky. So if you use the same password for your email that you use for your social media, or that you use, say, for your Amazon account, you know, that opens up quite a lot of avenues of attack against you.
Yeah, I get this warning which tells me that my passwords are compromised. And if I sat down and addressed that now, it would take me a long time because it's a list of 15 passwords. Should I? When you get the warning from Google.
I would advise it. And yes, it does take quite a long time. I've done it myself, but I think I had about 40 passwords that were compromised. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it's your password that has been compromised, you know, that my password attached to my email address has been compromised. What it means is that if you use a common word, that it may have shown up in a list of passwords that have been compromised, not necessarily linked to your account, but that it is out there and these passwords can be tried. So if you use like your dog's name, like 10 other people could have used that as a password, that's taken in a data breach from somebody else's account, but now it's a password that has been compromised. Okay. The best thing to do is change that.
Top tip, stop being lazy, stop ignoring the warnings and change your passwords.
Ciara O'Brien, business and technology journalist with the Irish Times, from Today with Claire Byrne. Now, it's funny how someone can just be in the middle of a light-hearted conversation about everyday items like lampshades, and then they tell you the most devastating health situation they've had to cope with. Have a listen to Eve O'Donoghue with Ryan in the morning.
I'm in Terryglass in North Tipperary, just on Loch Derg.
This is where the boats will break through the locks and maybe pull in and have a few beers there and
stay for
the night.
Yeah, and camper vans and campers. So, yeah, very busy spot.
I hope it's getting busier and busier with every weekend that's passing.
Yes, it is, absolutely. Yeah, no. Terryglass is a lovely spot, so there's a good tourist attraction, absolutely.
Lampshades!
Yes.
This is your stock and trade.
It is indeed, yes. It's an idea that came to me back in 2015.
Yeah.
I was working in the bank at the time, and I was doing up my sitting room and I had these fabulous curtains and I just wanted a pink lampshade and I could not find one.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, there's a bit of an opening here. But as I was working in the bank, I couldn't, you know, look at doing a business, leaving a business. I was a single parent with two children and doing it with a safe job, needed to stay there. But I actually became ill in 2016 with a condition called transverse myelitis, which left me paralysed from my neck down initially. But I did manage to get my arm back.
What age were you when that?
38.
What is it? Myelitis?
Transverse myelitis.
What does that do?
I got a virus and my immune system fought the virus. And whilst it was fighting the virus, it also attacked my spinal cord.
No.
So slowly but surely, I kind of lost power in my legs and it was moving up my body. So it took a few days for them to diagnose it in the hospital, but I was paralyzed to my neck. And when they diagnosed it, then I was given treatment and I managed to get my arms back, but I've been left permanently paralyzed from my chest down.
What is it like, if you don't mind me asking, when you're 38 years old and you're told you're paralyzed from the neck down? How do you respond to that? Or?
If I had been told a year earlier this was going to happen to me, I would have said I would never cope with it.
Yeah.
And it's just when you're in the situation, I think you just take one day at a time and, you know, I don't know where the strength came from, but it came from somewhere. And I was just focused and I was kind of like, if I get my arms back, at least if I get my arms back, I'll be very grateful for that. And thankfully I did. But unfortunately, I won't get the use of my legs back. It's not going to happen at this stage.
And that's 5 years ago now.
Yeah. So basically, I spent 6 years between University Hospital Galway, Dún Laoghaire, My house had to be completely gutted to suit the wheelchair. Moved back, had to live with my parents, but my children, myself, the two dogs all moved in with my parents.
Okay.
Renovated the house, moved back in home, and then I was kind of like, I need to be doing something. Every day was the same. You know, there was days I wouldn't even get out of bed, and I kind of like the lampshades. Because actually, the day I walked out of my house, the last day I walked, there was the lampshade, a glue gun, and fabric left on the table.
Really?
And I was like, okay, I think this is a sign. So basically, then I just started making a few lampshades for friends and family, set up the Facebook page, Instagram, did a few Christmas markets, and it's just progressed and progressed. And now over COVID, it's just taken off.
So you live in your own house, obviously. You're a wheelchair user full time.
Yeah.
Can I ask you, do you use an electric motorised one? Or
No, normal manual wheelchair.
Okay. Is that exhausting or is that just, that's life?
It's life. You've just, yeah, that's it now. You know, as one of the therapists in Dunleary said to me, you know, you don't curse this. This is what's getting you places. You know what I mean?
Okay.
It's an aid. So, you know, it change your perspective on things, you know. So I need it, if, you know.
And Ryan asked Aoife if she missed her old life in the financial sector.
Honestly, no. I always wanted to do something creative, but because I was a single parent and it was a reliable job, I couldn't take the risk of leaving that job. But then I was put in the situation. Sometimes I feel things happen for a reason. And if I hadn't have ended up paralysed in a wheelchair, Lola's lampshades wouldn't have come about.
What keeps you so in good form? I'm sure you're not in good form every day, like all of us. But what keeps you in fairly good form?
My perspective completely changed. Before I ended up paralysed, I was actually quite a negative person, and I used to look at what I didn't have.
Really?
And for some reason, then I would actually say I'm a happier person now than what I was beforehand. Now I look at what I do have, and I focus on what I have, and not what I don't have. You know,
so
there was days when I was upset one day, and Austin says to me, "Do you know, Mum, you could have actually, you know, you could have died, but you're here, you know, and, you know, our family." And so I focus on what I have. I have a fantastic family, fantastic friends, you know, who are just wonderful. And when you go through a situation like that, you really see how wonderful your family network and friends are, you know. So I'm very fortunate.
Lolaslampshades.ie if you want to have a look at Aoife's work. Aoife O'Donoghue on the Ryan Tubridy Show. And on Today with Claire Byrne, the rite of passage for many young people in the country is the stay in the Gaeltacht for Irish College. But again, not this year. Brian O'Connell was reporting in the morning.
I'm standing here in the heart of the Gaeltacht in Rain, County Waterford, on the 25-acre Irish College campus, Colossian Arena. I suppose little did anyone think in 2019 it would be 3 years before they could be hosting summer students again. And in the process, it's denying a rite of passage for so many Irish teenagers. The news came last week that Irish colleges would be cancelled this summer. The Minister of State for the Gaeltacht, Jack Chambers, said accommodation providers were concerned about bringing visiting children into their homes. Obviously, in the context of a public health situation, you can understand that. There will be some funding for government for providers, but beyond this year, concerns persist as to what Irish colleges may look like next summer, for example, and whether the old model can be done safely and what supports might be needed.
Now, it's awful for the teenagers who'd hope to go away, a rite of passage, as we said, but there's a big economic impact from all of this too.
Well, hundreds if not thousands of jobs are directly dependent on colleges across the country, and then you have all the businesses that depend on them during the summer and the families who host students. It's a very important income stream for them. So there's a very significant economic impact in areas like Ring here, where job creation can sometimes be difficult. Let's start, Claire, with some of those directly impacted. And for decades, Banantees have been taking teenagers into their homes over the summer. Vaira E. Varaku would usually at this time of year be getting ready to host, wait for it, 11 teenage girls. Can you imagine that? I mean, we have two and we struggle. But it's going to be a very quiet house for Vaira this summer, she told me, over a cup on tea.
Shaw and Ryark on Doris Tussig now, August Shin Ba Dun Garavon.
Stunning out there.
Yeah. So how she could tell us Banan Chitana go behind, so they enjoy being here. It's a holiday. They're by the sea, so they enjoy it. So like when they're here, the house is their home. And that's the way I look at it.
As we're having our freshly made scone. So every night, if I booked in here for the summer, I'd get a scone every night.
Well, not every night, but every other night you would have scones and tea. Well, generally the house rules are they get to keep their room nice and tidy and neat, and
that's me in trouble from the off anyway. Go on.
Accessible.
Mobile phones.
They're not. We take up the mobile phones at night. The Coláiste and the Scoláire are nearly part of the DNA of An Ryan. If you know, and you miss that, and
so yesterday you had a meeting with Jack Chambers. Did he wave the checkbook?
Not openly yet, no. But
well, I suppose the serious point is enough support has been put in place, do you think? Because you still have to keep your place ready for next year.
You do, yeah, you do. You got a certain percentage last year based on your overall numbers. Now the children and parents are in constant contact.
Is there any letters anymore?
No. No, and like it's sad, really. I would always try and encourage them to write a postcard while they're here.
What about the romances? You've seen heartbreaks over the years, I'd imagine you've seen.
Oh, I suppose so, yes. And it would involve Donal going to the top of the road, you know, where we're down at Paula Fuca now, and he'd be hiding at the top of the road to make sure there was nothing untoward going on.
As Moira there and Brian spoke to Nicholas McGrath, a teacher and farantee.
Yeah, we've been 30 years at it now, myself and my wife. Yeah, we do. We keep 16 students at a time.
16 students?
Yeah, 16 students, yeah. My wife is a very, she's able to handle all that. She's a cool, calm, she's a good cook. We do most of the work ourselves. Sometimes we might get one of the kids, local kids, in to give us a hand. 2 years in a row is a lot. And it's not just on Ryan, it's all the other Gaeltachts as well, you know, and they're all depend. A lot of people will be depending on it.
And it's part of the fabric of the community, isn't it? And trying to retain that sense of identity here.
Oh, yeah, for over 120 years or more now, students have been coming here learning Irish.
There is talk of government supports. Is enough being done, do you think?
Like, we still have to maintain our homes up to a standard, like that's in the fire regulations, health and safety, all of that kind. That all costs money. We have to get engineers' reports every year, so an annual thing. That's all. There's a cost in all of that, like. And last year, they paid out some of the grant money, which comes with the kids as grant money as well. So we got some of that last year. I don't know what the story is this year so far. I haven't heard whether they're paying out the grant money or not. I don't think anyone is really complaining. Do you know what I'm saying? But we're kind of disappointed it's not there. And we're hoping for, you know, for next year at least, that maybe when everybody's vaccinated. And it's not possible, I think, to take people into your home.
I mean, I was going to ask you that. Do you think it's ultimately the right decision?
Oh, it is the right decision, yeah. Because if you look at, I suppose, the fabric that makes up all of those banatees around the place, there are a lot of are olders, like 50s, 60s, you know. I myself, I'm in my 50s, my wife is in her 50s. I have asthma, my wife has asthma, my daughter has asthma. And I have diabetes, so I have an underlying condition. I've already got my first shot. I'm getting my second shot in 2 days' time. Yeah, it is the right decision.
Nicholas from Brian O'Connell's report from Today with Claire Byrne. And on the Ray Darcy Show, the memory man, Dr. Charles Garavan.
So you were fascinated from an early age about memory and how to best recall things that you needed to remember.
Yeah, well, my dad had bought a book by a magician called Harry Lorraine back in the 60s. And when I was about 16, he gave me the tattered copy, thinking it would help me with studying. And it was useful for doing a few sort of tricks, but I couldn't really apply it to anything. So I was sort of exposed to the ideas early on, but it was really only in my 20s when I read an article about a man called Dominic O'Brien, who was the world memory champion, and I bought his book. That was the point where I really started to get interested.
And you competed yourself in memory competitions?
I went to a few, yeah. I did okay. I think by the standards of what people do in memory competitions now, not great. So I was able to memorise a pack of cards in about a minute, but the world record's about 15 seconds. So it's a bit like saying you could run 100 metres in 50 seconds. It's not
great.
Not great compared to what other people can do.
So hold on. So somebody can look at a shuffled pack of cards and remember the order in 15 seconds.
Yeah, little under 15 seconds.
That's phenomenal.
It's actually impressive to be able to even look through them that quickly, let alone memorise them.
Just go off on a little bit of a tangent here now. So are people born with talents, gifts when it comes to memory?
I suppose like everything else, it varies, like height and intelligence and everything else. Yeah. But no one is born really with the ability to memorise a pack of cards in 15 seconds. That's based on techniques that you learn and then practice. though I think the people who are quite visual and have very good concentration tend to do better in these competitions.
Is there such thing as a photographic memory? Is that scientifically proven?
Well, there have been a small number of people who can draw a picture which looks like a photograph of a scene that they've seen. And there are some people who can remember a few facts about every day of their lives. So you can give them any date and they can tell you what they were wearing, what they had for dinner, what the weather was like.
This is just... They didn't set out to do that.
No, that's completely natural.
Okay.
But in terms of the idea of being able to look at a book, just look at a page and recall it perfectly, that doesn't really seem to exist. So perfect recall of facts and things, that seems to be something you need to work at. Though there are some people who are better at it than others.
And I'm sure there are people listening, a bit like me, who if they read a paper, for example, they'll remember where... a particular thing was positioned on the page. Similarly, in a book, you'll know where you saw something.
Yeah.
So that's everybody has a bit of that, do they?
Yeah. Well, I suppose that's sort of bound up with our memory for locations and places. Is you would imagine a very old part of the brain.
Right.
You know, most animals can find their way around in the world. So, and I think sometimes when you read a story, you're experiencing something rather than learning facts, and our memories for events that happen to us are very much bound up with the place where they happened. So, for instance, the police will often take someone back to the scene of a crime because they'll remember more there than they will, obviously, if they're not too traumatised, witnesses.
And you say that failing to remember something isn't a failure in the brain, it's a design flaw. And I know that there are loads of different sort of little tricks. Is one of them a story? Is that one of the memory tricks? I remember if you place things on a pathway and you travel along the pathway, then you can remember things.
That's called the Loci technique, right, or the Journey technique, or the Roman Room technique. And that's really what people are using in memory competitions. So if you wanted to remember a shopping list, what you would do is take each pair of items on the list, make a weird visual image associating them together, and then see that in a particular place along a journey, say in your bedroom, on your bed, in front of the wardrobe, outside your bedroom, in the loo, you know, following a little journey around your house. And then when you wanted to remember the list, you'd go back to the first place on the journey and the images would remind you of those words. So it's just a slightly more complicated version of that to memorize numbers or cards or really anything you can turn into a picture. You can use that technique.
What's your favorite technique? What works best for you?
Well, those techniques are very good for learning lists of words, but the thing that was really a revelation to me from memory competitions was the importance of testing yourself on the information that you want to remember rather than relearning it or re-seeing it or re-reading it. So I think that's really the key to...
Cool, go on, explain that to me.
To memory. So if there are, let's say, if there's a shopping list you want to remember, or foreign language vocabulary, or you're studying for an exam and you have your notes, the best way to learn that is not to just read it over and over again. It's to read it, then put it away, test yourself and see what you can remember, and then look back.
Dr. Charles Garavan on The Ray D'Arcy Show. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.